Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a video released by the French government, which has gone viral, of Ivanka Trump gatecrashing a private conversation between world leaders Prime Minister May, President Macron, Prime Minister Trudeau, and the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, at the G20 meeting, where Ivanka interjects with an inane comment that clearly puzzles and annoys the huddle, causing them to disperse. Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University who served as U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, joins us to discuss this case of nepotism gone wild as Trump places his daughter on the American side of the negotiating table opposite Xi Jinping and has her stepping into North Korea with him in what Ivanka describes as a surreal moment. We'll assess whether a majority of the American people will be sufficiently outraged by the embarrassing amateurism of this crass, classless, and clueless family representing the United States abroad to vote them all off the island in 2020. Furthermore, just the cost of the VIP accommodations for Trump's adult children in London recently when they all visited the Queen, which set back the American taxpayer for $1,223,230, should surely get the attention of the American people, at least not those in the Fox News bubble. Then we'll speak with Adele Stand, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who is currently the editor of Right Wing Watch and a columnist at the American Prospect, where she has an article, Trump and Bannon Busting Up the World. She joins us to discuss the latest book by Michael Wolff, in which Wolff's main source, Stephen Bannon, dismisses Ivanka and her husband, Jared Kushner, as, quote, a pair of grifters. However, the president's daughter and son-in-law together nevertheless play an increasingly prominent role in American diplomacy as major players in Trump's family-style approach to foreign policy. We will also respond to remarks by Fox News host Tucker Carlson on Sunday on Fox and Friends, where he defended Trump's praise for the North Korean dictator, saying part of leading a country, quote, means killing people. Then finally, we'll get an assessment of whether there was some substance beyond the photo op and the Trump family grandstanding on the DMZ with Kim Jong-un, and speak with Stephen Norper, the Korea Society Senior Director for Policy at Columbia University, who was a former State Department senior analyst and fellow at Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security. He joins us to discuss Trump's apparent comfort hanging out with despots at the G20 and his love for the cruel young North Korean dictator with possibly the world's worst human rights record. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, who is a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University, who served as U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, during which time she led initiatives in cultural diplomacy, biotechnology, cybersecurity, and education. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Cynthia Snyder.
Thank you very much for having me.
And what did you make of this video that's gone viral that was released by the French government of a huddle of world leaders, Prime Minister Theresa May of the UK, President Macron of France, Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada, and Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, were huddled in a private conversation, and Ivanka Trump sort of gatecrashes the conversation, makes a somewhat inane and puzzling remark, which everybody sort of looks rather stunned by and uncomfortable by, and then quickly the huddle disperses. So it wasn't exactly, I mean, I found it frankly embarrassingly amateurish. How did it strike you as a former diplomat?
I was just going to say that you've chosen the absolutely correct word, which is embarrassing. And, you know, it's so clear to anyone watching this short but painful to watch video that, you know, she has no place there. But the, and of course the question that comes to mind is, you know, have you no shame? But we all know the answer to that question for any member of the Trump family. They are just so blindingly lacking in any kind of self-awareness that, of course, she, you know, can't see that she's has no place there. And, you know, she can't see the hypocrisy of her speaking out for women's empowerment while she is serving in her father's administration. Just, I mean, just one example, think of one of the most impressive examples of women empowerment happening right now before our very eyes. That is the American Women's Cup soccer team, who President Trump continuously insults. You know, so the idea, I mean, just the gall to stand up and speak about women's empowerment on behalf of this administration is absolutely breathtaking. You know, I have to say, though, I fear I know what you might be thinking of, because it is true that she is not the first unelected member of an administration to speak about women's empowerment. What is the most famous comment about that anyone can think of? I think it's Hillary Clinton's comment in Beijing. You know, women's rights are human rights, which was a comment that was heard around the world and made a tremendous impact, as did her entire speech, which she made as First Lady. You know, she wasn't elected to be there, but what she had, which Ivanka Trump completely lacks, Hillary Clinton had a lifelong record of fighting for women and children. And she had deep, deep knowledge of the issue. She had studied it. She had spoken with people about it around the world, as well as intensively inside the United States. So she had earned on her own, you know, from her own regard, respect for her standing as someone who, you know, First Lady or not, could stand up and speak about this issue. There is just a world of difference between that example from the past and what has gone on at the G20.
Well, she also, Ivanka Trump, gatecrashed this group photo, put herself in the front row where all the prominent world leaders were, and then sort of had to slip into the back row because she was, you know, they had to make room for Angela Merkel. It's not as if she doesn't know her place. She thinks that she's almost, you know, above equals.
Well, again, it's this complete lack of actually respect for democratic processes and, you know, traditions, which this family shows continuously. And, you know, I don't know, are the world leaders eventually, the next G20, are they just going to say, we do not want her here? I don't know, probably not. They're afraid of President Trump. They don't want to antagonize him. And, you know, you certainly can't wait for either President Trump or Ivanka Trump to pick up any of the blindingly obvious clues that are being dropped. I mean, they will just ignore it.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador...
So this will probably happen again.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University, who served as the United States Ambassador to the Netherlands, during which time she led initiatives in cultural diplomacy, biotechnology, cybersecurity, and education. So the other major photo op involving Ivanka Trump was, of course, Donald Trump stepped into North Korea to stand side by side with Kim Jong-un, but he also invited his daughter to step into North Korea, and of course she said it was a surreal moment. That was a pretty prominent photo of. So she was, if I were the Secretary of State, and I know he refers to Ivanka and his Secretary of State Pompeo as the beauty and the beast, I think the beast has got to be feeling a little sidelined, wouldn't you say?
Well, again, you're talking about someone who has no shame, you know, who goes around the world representing this administration, which on a daily basis violates, you know, the core principles that the United States stands for. So I have no idea how Secretary of State Pompeo feels about this. The only idea I have, you know, is that he really doesn't, in my view, understand very well what his position means. And he's willing to debase himself on a daily basis for President Trump. So I imagine he is willing to do it over this also.
Well, it is. At what point, though, if the American people, or at least a sufficient number of them, and arguably we've had a tyranny of the minority since this minority president came along, he was 3 million votes plus short in the popular vote. His ratings have never gotten up past 40s, mid-40s, I guess, never been at a 50% point yet. He does seem to be sort of getting actually more comfortable, believe it or not. The press conference that he did at the end of the G20 was the most successful he's had so far. He didn't insult people. He didn't go off the rails. For an hour and a half, he answered some tough questions from both the White House press corps and the international press corps. So this is what's so puzzling is, how do you break that spell? All the stuff that you're saying and all the stuff that I believe, and I'm continually embarrassed and absolutely amazed that this person is representing the United States to the world. Nevertheless, it seems to be difficult to get rid of him. Obviously, you have to do it through the ballot box. Impeachment doesn't seem to be something that the Democratic opposition want to embrace at this moment. So would the cost that this family nepotism involved, would that register with the American people? I mean, it cost $1,223,230 just for the VIP accommodation for Trump's adult children at the visit to Buckingham Palace to meet with the Queen a couple of weeks back. So what do you think it's going to take? I guess I'm sorry to go so long, but I'm genuinely puzzled as to.
No, I think you and I are in violent agreement on this. I think it's going to take a strong Democratic candidate, and that's it. Because what we've learned over the past 2 years, and it is really disheartening. It's genuinely disheartening about the American people, but the truth is undeniable. We have learned that those, you know, somewhere between, it goes between 36% to 44% of people will never leave Trump. What he said when he was a candidate, that he could shoot someone in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue and his followers would still follow him, that sadly was correct then, and it is still correct now. I think he gets there by appealing to the basest instincts, that is resentment and racism. That's the key to his power. And sadly, a lot of people in our country feel insecure and are susceptible to those sentiments of resentment and racism. And we live in an era, as you well know, as someone in the media, where people only listen to media outlets that reinforce the opinions they already have. And so all these supporters are listening to Fox News. So they're not getting any of these negative reports. None. And they simply don't believe they're true. They just don't believe it. So I think the key, and then Trump himself, you know, he lies all the time. He denies things. He says it whenever he doesn't like it. He says it's fake news. And, you know, for whatever reason, these people lap it up. So I think you just have to dismiss those people and just say 44% of the country, we are simply writing off and forget it. And then you have to concentrate on the rest, which is a majority. And, you know, the Democrats have a larger number of voters. And we have to do everything possible to make sure those voters vote. Because if they vote, Trump will lose.
Well, you mentioned Fox News and people being in a bubble of delusion where they're impervious to facts and information. And to my mind, actually, as much as I am appalled by President Trump, I'm even more appalled by Rupert Murdoch, who I think is his number one enabler and perhaps even more responsible, arguably. But on Fox News, on Fox and Friends on Sunday, Tucker Carlson, one of the Fox News hosts, was talking about the photo op of Trump and Kim Jong-un at Panmunjom on the DMZ. And he said, you know, that, you know, obviously North Korea, I don't want to defend the regime. But I'm quoting him, on the other hand, you've got to be honest about what it means to lead a country. It means killing people. Not on the scale the North Koreans do, but a lot of countries commit atrocities, including a number that we are closely allied with. And it's not relativist or anything. It's the nature of life and certainly the nature of power. You have to choose between the bad people and the worst people. I do not think that's how the president sees it. He's far less sentimental about this stuff. So that is just stunning. I mean, it's bad enough that Trump himself has a disregard for human rights. But the idea that his cheer squad think it's okay to kill people, have you ever heard anything like that?
No, I must say, I'm embarrassed to say I live in my own little bubble. I don't listen to Tucker Carlson very often at all. I am truly horrified by that. It is just unbelievable. And it, as I keep repeating, I'm sorry to say, violates everything that the United States actually does stand for. We actually do not believe that being in power means killing people. Absolutely not. And I think what you've seen, and believe me, I don't think it's nearly as strong a reaction as I would like to see, but you have nonetheless seen a reaction to the findings from one, now most recently the UN, the findings that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia was responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. That's one person, but it's like a case that is staring you in the face and you cannot deny it. The man was killed, and all of the evidence points to the Crown Prince as being the responsible party. Now, the Trumps, of course, dismissed that, but the majority of public opinion in America believes it, and importantly, you have just seen recently from our Congress, the Senate and the House, blocking an order that Trump was trying to go around the Senate to continue to arm sales to Saudi Arabia, and it was blocked. So you are beginning, and it's, I don't know how long it will last and how strong it will get, but you are beginning to see some resistance from the Congress to President Trump, and an indication that this outrageous view that Tucker Carlson articulated is not one that is widely held.
Well, just in closing, because Trump was sort of yucking it up at the G20 and the photo ops with Mohammed bin Salman, and he was also, you know, having a laugh with Vladimir Putin about killing journalists, and envious of Putin's ability to kill journalists. Over here, he calls them the enemy of the people, but he's not exactly able to go out and get rid of pesky journalists like Putin is. It is absolutely surreal, but in a serious sense, you've just brought it up in terms of the Congress both voting against MBS and holding him responsible for the murder of Khashoggi, along with cutting off the arms sales to Yemen. The Saudi Arabians, of course, are also the reason why the pro-democracy people in Sudan can't get rid of the generals. The Saudis and the Emiratis are using the Sudanese military as proxies to fight in Yemen, and the Saudi Arabians do not want any form of glimmer of democracy and people power. And so they're stamping it out, just as they helped Sisi and the generals in Egypt stamp out the Arab Spring. So it's not just as, that it's really embarrassing to see our president shoulder to shoulder with a murderer, but what they're doing is, that government's policies are, is I think they've done so much damage around the world and spreading a lot of hatred and division. But what's going on in Sudan and Yemen today as we speak is just absolutely grotesque.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I would put Egypt right squarely in that category. You know, Sisi has 50,000 political prisoners. And you just had the former president, Mohamed Morsi, dropped dead in court in Egypt. And surely that's a result of the terrible treatment he had in prison. I mean, the entire opposition party in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood, of whom I'm no particular fan, but they are the opposition party, they're all in jail, every single one of them, who, you know, either they're in jail or they escaped the country. And, you know, and this is a very close ally, and who recently actually visited the United States. Now, in fairness to President Trump, I think you have to, you know, state the truth, which is that Egypt and Saudi Arabia and, you know, Bahrain, UAE, Qatar, these countries have been strong allies of the United States for a long time, including under President Obama, including under President Clinton. Having them as allies is not a new idea. What is new and very scary and dramatically undercuts, I mean, basically eliminates the United States' soft power in the world, the position of the United States as a model or an example that other countries want to follow, is the president as an individual embracing these policies. You know, before they were our allies, and that is true. This is not an invention of Trump's. But there was at least some expression of criticism of the authoritarian policies. Now we have expressions, as you said, of envy of these authoritarian policies. And it's no joke.
Well,
it is absolutely no joke. And that is a 360-degree turn. And there's never been anything like that. And just to come back to our original topic of Ivanka Trump speaking on the empowerment of women, and in the same breath saying that she can't wait to go to the G20, which will be next hosted by Saudi Arabia, where they have imprisoned and are torturing, and I believe have sentenced to death at least one of the women who led the protest that enabled women to drive. You know, I mean, if you want to look at the idea that an American, any American, and only Ivanka Trump could do it, is going to go to Saudi Arabia, of all places, and talk about the empowerment of women. You know, it is just truly horrifying. And the examples you bring up of the slaughter, the wholesale slaughter going on in Yemen and in the Sudan, perpetrated by the Saudis with UAE and supported by the United States, is truly horrifying.
Well, Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Cynthia Snyder, who's a professor of diplomacy at Georgetown University. She served as U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, during which time she led initiatives in cultural diplomacy, biotechnology, cybersecurity, and education. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with a response to remarks by Fox News host Tucker Carlson, where he defended Trump's praise for the North Korean dictator, saying part of leading a country means killing people.
Criminal and all the sinners.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C. She's currently the editor of Right Wing Watch, a weekly columnist for the American Prospect and a contributor to SiriusXM Progress. And her recent article at the American Prospect is Trump and Bannon Busting Up the World, and she has a forthcoming article about Mike Pence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Adele. And we were just talking with a former U.S. ambassador, teaches diplomacy at Georgetown, Ambassador Cynthia Snyder. I asked her about how she feels, having been a representative of the United States and an American diplomat, about the nepotism gone wild with the Trump administration's family-style diplomacy with this extraordinary video that's gone viral that the French released of a huddle of world leaders, Prime Minister May, President Macron, Prime Minister Trudeau, and the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde. They're having an intense discussion, and who wanders up to the camera, butts her way in, gate crashes the huddle, and makes an inane remark that they all look completely mystified by, and then eventually they all disperse. And, I mean, let me just start off on a really bitchy note, if I can. She was wearing this hideous dress. I mean, she's supposed to be this fashionista, but she looked like a Disney princess dress my granddaughter wears.
Well,
you know,
a princess dress is probably apt. It's probably an apt description, right? Because that's what Ivanka Trump is. She is, you know, a self-styled princess. What else? What other claim to any kind of authority does she have other than being her father's daughter? And to have her literally edging out of an official photo of the gathering on the border between North and South Korea between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. I mean, she literally edged Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, out of the photograph. I mean, it's just extraordinary. It's extraordinary. She has absolutely no expertise in diplomacy, and yet she is trying to style herself as a diplomat.
Right, and her father has said that she may succeed him in 2024.
Right.
So look out for the Trump dynasty. It's bad enough having the Kim dynasty. but one of the things that, you know, Stephen Bannon, and I know you've written about him, Trump and Bannon busting up the world, and your forthcoming articles on Mike Pence's lies at the American Prospect.
Yeah, and I did a couple of pieces in the interim on the European Union parliamentary elections in which Bannon was, you know, had quite a hand.
So we don't have to, it's redundant to talk about the evil Bannon represents, but he's very much the source of this new book by Michael Wolff, and indeed the source of the previous book. That's why he got fired, because of Fire and Fury, what it revealed about him. So he occasionally, maybe it's like a broken watch is right twice a day, but one of the things he said about the Mueller report I thought was pretty on the point. He said, you know, in terms of Mueller, never send a Marine to do a hitman's job. But the way he's described Jared and Ivanka, he has absolutely no bones about it. He said,
yeah,
you know,
he's got contempt for them.
He said that they are a pair of grifters. And that is what is going on. If you actually read Wolff's new book, he points out, and he has quite a lot of documentation, that what's really happened in this administration is as soon as they got into the White House, Jared Kushner hung up a shingle, told every dictator around the world, you don't have to deal with the State Department, the Defense Department, the American government bureaucracy, just deal with me. And, of course, dictators and kleptocrats love that kind of thing. And he is just making deals hand over fist. When they leave office, the Trumps and the Kushners, you better believe that the Trump organization and the Kushner company will have sovereign wealth money from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf pouring into their real estate businesses. This is an amazing...
I would be shocked if they did not. Yes, absolutely.
So this is what's really going on, and I just am stunned that people can't see the obvious here. It's bad enough that they go around the world, the whole family, they spent 1.2 something million just on accommodation for the Trump family in London when they're visiting the Queen. But
right.
The grifting that's going on at the highest level.
But there's no small irony in Bannon himself, you know, making that assertion when we see him, you know, traveling on somebody's dime all over the world to organize the far-right parties of Europe, you know, to form an anti-democratic bloc in the EU. And he's staying in five-star hotels, and he only travels by private plane, and you know. So, I mean, it's really, you know, it's just that Bannon, in some ways, even though he got himself fired, which I'm not sure wasn't, you know, half deliberate, is, you know, it's the pot calling the kettle black in a sense. Bannon's just more, you know, he has more of a sense of purpose about what he's after, you know, while he's, you know, having his Michelin meals in the Hotel Bristol. You know, he's on a mission,
right.
You know, to foment the causes of nationalism throughout the world. So the whole thing, it's always been a plunder project from the start. I mean, between the sell-off of the public lands to mining interests in order to appease them, right, to the Trump family's own, you know, looting of the global economy by making deals with these dictators, it's just one big plunder project. But the thing is, they've been so good at weaponizing the resentments of people who want to blame their misfortunes on others and not on rich white people.
Right. Well, you mentioned in your article, Dale Stan, at the American Prospect, Trump and Bannon busting up the world, about Bannon and the Islamophobe Frank Gaffney getting together this Committee on the Present Danger, China. Of course, the original Committee on the Present Danger came up during the Carter administration to help launch Reagan. And that was led by Paul Wolfowitz, who brought us the Iraq War. But they had they had a meeting at the St. Regis in New York. The guy who's funding Bannon for these meetings and these private jets and five-star meals, etc., is a guy called Miles Kwok, an exiled Chinese billionaire, lives in the Sherry Netherlands on Central Park. He's his latest sugar daddy after he lost Mercer.
I don't know that we know that Mercer's still not on board.
Yeah, well, he might be.
All we know is what Mercer has told people, and there's plenty of ways to push money to people where you will never find out what its source is, right? I mean, so Mercer was the one who funded the Brexit project. This EU disaggregation thing project is of the same. It's using the same players from the UK. I mean, I don't know that I accept the fact that, you know, we need to believe that Mercer is totally out of the picture.
Right, but you can see why Miles Kwok is getting his money's worth if they're attacking China's government.
China, of course, and it's not just the Chinese government. It's also, you remember that Bannon was very involved in creating the false narrative around Hillary Clinton regarding a deal that was done or signed off on by the State Department regarding a firm that Russia had some interest in called Uranium One. And you know, those accusations were pushed through a Bannon entity called the Government Accountability Institute. And now the guy who wrote that book for Bannon, because that Government Accountability Institute was a Bannon enterprise, it now still exists but without Bannon, is a guy named Peter Schweizer, who's now pushing a narrative about Joe Biden and China. So I see this all of a piece where, you know, the Republican oppo shops of the world are seeking to highlight deals that Hunter Biden, the son of the former vice president, made in China.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Adele Stan, since you are currently the editor of Right Wing Watch and you have covered the intersection of religion and politics for some time, the the right-wing squawk box, Fox News, the Pravda of the Republican Party and the Trump administration, they really hit an all-time low with Tucker Carlson in a phone interview on Fox and Friends on Sunday. He went on to say, talking about Trump's photo op with Kim Jong-un at the DMZ, he said, I'm not defending the North Korean regime, but, quote, on the other hand, you've got to be honest about what it means to lead a country. It means killing people.
Kill people.
Not on the scale the North Koreans do, but a lot of countries commit atrocities, including a number that we are closely allied with. And it's not relativist or anything. It's the nature of life and certainly the nature of power. The bad people and the worst people. It's a choice between the bad people and worse. I don't think that's how the president sees it. He's far less sentimental about this stuff. What do you think of that?
I think there's a reason that Tucker Carlson is the favorite of, you know, white supremacists like Andrew Anglin, who runs the Daily Stormer website. I mean, they see him as advancing their own, you know, love of authoritarianism and white supremacy. And, you know, Carlson proved it. I mean, there you have it. So I think that you really do see that, you know, Fox News is an arm of this administration, not simply a squawk box for the Republican Party. And I do believe that this administration is at its heart white supremacist as well. So, you know, there you go. I mean, all is in a nutshell. There is the ethos. Jared Kushner hanging out, having a you know, a sleepover with Mohammed bin Salman, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It's all just rolled up right there in Carlson's comment.
Well, you mean you can be a white supremacist, but you can take money from an Arab potentate, and you can have a love affair with a North Korean mass murderer?
Sure, because if you're enabling white nationalists and white supremacists on your own behalf, and given the things that Trump has had to say about black people and brown people, I mean, sure, absolutely, because that's just another means of obtaining power, right? And these guys all understand what each other are up to, so they're not going to stand on ceremony or principles. You know, each his own way of accruing power, and it usually has to do with demonizing somebody. So if they're all going to do business together, I mean, the deals are what's more important to these guys than any kind of principles whatsoever.
Well, Adele Stan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Adele. And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently the editor of Right Wing Watch and a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, and a contributor to SiriusXM Progress. And her recent articles at The American Prospect are Trump and Bannon Busting Up the World, and she has a forthcoming article on Mike Pence's lies. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an assessment of whether there was some substance beyond the photo op and the Trump family grandstanding on the DMZ with Kim Jong-un.
Man has invented his doom. First step was touching the moon. There's a woman on my block, and she sits there in a cold chill. She says, who's gonna take away his license to kill?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Norper, who's a professor, the Korea Society's Senior Director for Policy, and an associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute and Pacific Forum, CSIS, at Columbia University, a former State Department senior analyst. He's held fellowships at the East-West Institute, the East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Norper.
Thank you, Ian.
So I spoke yesterday with your colleague, Charles Armstrong, who actually was not, you know, I was somewhat cynical, saying, well, it does seem like a photo opportunity of Kim and Trump, and particularly Trump stepping into North Korea. And he even said, Trump himself said that, you know, this is going to be good for both of us in terms of publicity. And it would have been a disaster had Kim not shown up. So he sort of admitted that it was something of a photo opportunity. But your colleague actually thought there was some substance to it, and not in, in as much as what was discussed in those 50 minutes. But in general, he was suggesting there may even be a personal relationship, which Trump keeps saying exists. And in this case, a somewhat like a father and son relationship between Trump and Kim. Do you detect anything like that?
Well, certainly, I think I would go as far as to say there seems to be a rapport. And more than that, I think that it's a matter of respective interest. The president would like a foreign policy victory going into what will certainly be a rough and tough U.S. political season. And Chairman Kim clearly needs economic relief and is looking to pursue sort of economic modernization. That means a lessening of sanctions. That brings him to the table. And then Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, is facing some dwindling numbers in the polls, some questions at home about his viability relative to the inter-Korean reconciliation process. So it's really more of interest aligning, regardless of personalities. There is a Confucian aspect where Kim may be deferential in that regard, and Trump picks up on that. But you know, despite the personal rapport, it really, in my mind, comes down to a lot to be gained in terms of restarting the process at this point in time, before we get later in the year when things become more hectic and when the U.S. president is more distracted by domestic politics.
But should we sort of pinch ourselves and remind ourselves that this Kim Jong-un has murdered his family members, used a weapon of mass destruction against his half-brother, apparently executes people by using anti-aircraft guns and flamethrowers, has a huge number of his population have starved to death. And the gulags, I think per capita, are probably the highest prison population, political prison population in the world. I don't think it bothers Trump. He seems to think you can end up building condos on the unspoiled beaches of North Korea. But is that a factor anymore, do you think?
Well, it's more, and it's right for you to list the number of concerns that the United States and the international community have about North Korea. They present certainly at least a challenge relative to nuclear and missile proliferation, relative to human rights concerns, relative to what the United Nations has defined as Nazi-era atrocities at this current date. And it really does cause one to wake up and say, look, is this the kind of regime that you want to persist? Clearly the answer is no. But perhaps what the United States in the longer term is banking on is that this too will go the way of history, and that the North Korean regime, like the Soviet regime, about which we had concerns relative to human rights, the curtailment of civil liberties, and clearly, you know, for a long period of time, a gulag reality, you know, overcoming those concerns, not to mention the nuclear concerns at the time, to try to strike at some agreement to arrive at some stability and to encourage some sort of economic change. In the case of the Soviets, that meant really the elimination of the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War, right? Because of perestroika, the economic reopening and glasnost. But one needs to wait and see whether that happens. The North Koreans are tough and small and isolated, which affords them a certain resiliency. And clearly we don't want to, you know, encourage all that concerns us in the international arena, but rather check that. The South Korean president seems to feel that that happens by bringing them to the negotiating table and encouraging an inter-Korean reconciliation process that will at some point hold them accountable. So it's a lot to do with the pacing, the timing, and what one wants to see in the end. But for the foreseeable future, eliminating that missile and nuclear threat is at the top of the U.S. administration's list.
So just in the broader sense, you mentioned, Stephen Norbert, Trump getting into a campaign mode in, you know, not even a campaign year, it's a campaign year and a half. But that's the way we do it, I guess. And I'm stuck covering it, so it's an onerous task. But still, do you think that there is an element here in terms of the North Koreans and the Trump administration having, you know, this sort of rapprochement? First of all, I think Trump is going to be a more difficult candidate to beat for the Democrats, because at the press conference after the G20, he really took it in his stride an hour and a half before the White House press corps and the international press corps. For the first time, I think he handled himself very well, answered all of the questions, didn't get nasty, didn't get personal, didn't get snarky, or wasn't embarrassing. And, you know, this photo op, as much as we call it a photo op, does seem to have been useful, and South Korea seem to be happy with it. There's less tension on the DMZ. But is there an element here of the family? Because it was so extraordinary to see Ivanka Trump step into North Korea with Trump. And is that an element, since you're dealing with a family dynasty in Pyongyang? In other words, dynasty.
It's an interesting point, Ian. And perhaps, you know, we're in this odd reality where the way that the Trump administration has operated, and I'm sure much to the consternation of professionals at the State Department and probably even some advisors, is one where there's a disproportionate level of access by Ivanka Trump and Bob Jared. And so, you know, that seems to be the way that this president operates. And maybe there's some resiliency to Kim Jong-un in the sense that that's a family dynasty. It is, you know, atypical in the sense that it is a Confucian communist a dynasty that's seen three generations, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un. And so, you know, maybe they see something. Maybe some of the more despotic regimes understand that sort of paternalistic and dynastic-based reality that is different. And there has been suggestion that Trump is trying to create a situation where he imagines Ivanka to be running in 2024, and maybe there's, you know, whispers of a Trump dynasty. I don't know. As a political scientist, I simply, you know, probably can speculate the same as anyone else on that, but I have no, you know, real firm sense other than the fact that it's a personality-led politics, and that's very different from the more process-oriented realities that have led to negotiations in the past, where you have multiple working groups and advisors, and then finally presidents meet, and this seems to be going in the opposite direction. At the end, the most important aspect in my mind is trying to stem the likelihood of any outbreak of conflict, and certainly the maintenance of a moratorium against missile and nuclear tests is very, very important, and the administration has declared victory in terms of that having maintained itself. But the bigger questions you raise about the process and about the family involvement are well worth considering for those of us keen on understanding American foreign policy and how it's executed better.
But in terms of your experience in the State Department, Stephen, recently the transcripts of the closed session that former Secretary of State Tillerson had with the House Foreign Affairs Committee were leaked, and there's quite a number of alarming responses from remarks from Tillerson, particularly about how much he was undercut, or he felt he was undercut, by the family diplomacy of the son-in-law, Jared Kushner. In one instance, he walks into a upscale Washington restaurant, and there in the corner huddled is the Mexican foreign minister and Jared Kushner, who, of course, the Mexican foreign minister looked incredibly sheepish, and Tillerson said to him, next time you're in town, give me a call. So for a State Department professional, it's got to be pretty demoralizing, doesn't it? Particularly if you're the boss, the Secretary of State, and to find yourself basically I mean, they were left out of the loop in, for example, both him and Mattis, the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, over the fact that Jared Kushner and his friend Mohammed bin Salman decided to blockade Qatar, apparently without even realizing, or at least the president apparently didn't realize, that the biggest American base was there. So the two adults in the room, Secretary of State Tillerson and Secretary of Defense Mattis, had to intervene. But it was that's an example of this bizarre new form of foreign policy, the Trump family style foreign policy.
It is quite different for all the reasons that you suggested, and the fact that Tillerson had come from a major leadership role in the private sector as chairman of Exxon had probably really also rankled him the wrong way, having been an executive. And clearly, Secretary Mattis had a long and very distinguished military career, and as a four-star general, had not been used to being relegated to the sidelines, and both on stepping away from the administration cited their concerns about a lack of viability in the process and a level of transparency and accountability that's much needed and that normally functions in our democracy, because you do have professionals who work at the Departments of State and Defense, on the National Security Council, and all the components. And we've seen Trump challenge the assessments of his intelligence chiefs, and that certainly has rankled the various intelligence communities. Clearly, the diplomats are upset because they have been sidelined at times. And it's the foreign policy making that seems to be part and parcel, as you describe, for the administration. The question about what next? Clearly, if the next president is not Trump, there'll be a serious job of repair work needed, not only in terms of international relations, but really the host of processes within government and in a revisiting of those components of American foreign policy formation. But I think that there's got to be very serious questions about morale among the professionals. And people seem to be having to deal with just a very different format here. And again, that personality-based politics is something that is known more in systems that tend to be autocratic or tend to be, in the current situation, populist and nationalistic. And that's just a different game altogether. So revisiting the hallmark foundations of our democracy in terms of checks and balances and in terms of the components in place that really guarantee more proper transparency, accountability, and the rule of law really are at stake here.
Well, in terms of, we talked earlier, Stephen Norper, about human rights or the apparent disregard of human rights in terms of Trump's transactional form of family-to-family, personality-to-personality. And, of course, he is a former reality TV guy. So the staging of the meet and greet on the DMZ was impressive. And obviously, this is his skill. But, you know, he's got this sort of sycophantic chorus at Fox News, with Fox and Friends, etc. And Tucker Carlson, one of their hosts, said he wasn't going to defend the North Korean regime, but just quoting him. But on the other hand, you got to be honest about what it means to lead a country. It means killing people. Not on the scale the North Koreans do, but a lot of countries commit atrocities, including a number that we are closely allied to. It's not a relativist or anything. It's the nature of life and certainly the nature of power. And I think that's how the president sees it. He's far less sentimental about this stuff. I find that deeply disturbing, frankly.
No, absolutely, certainly. And for those of us who grew up over decades of U.S. leadership that had a certain level of moral certainty, where the United States was the exemplar for the free world, this is quite a different reality. And it appears that the president sits more comfortably with autocrats like Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, is more comfortable in the context of these populist nationalist type arguments, and that the real cost then is into the longer-term example of the United States internationally and the credibility of the United States in the international arena. Reflecting on what's happening in Hong Kong now, you have these massive demonstrations of citizens out trying to oppose this extradition bill, which would lead to forced extradition to mainland China, where there is not a rule of law. And so they're out there in a democratic struggle. And historically, the United States, you know, would have been out very strongly in support. But in this day and age, the moral beacon for democracy seems to be less with the United States. And so it's important to remember that. It's important, I think, for those in the U.S. government and in this administration to really consider what the impact is. You mentioned what's happened in Saudi Arabia as well, and the fact that Jamal Khashoggi perished in the way he did. Yet the accommodation made again and again to the Saudis really leaves one scratching heads, and to think that you know, Trump and Jared and others accommodate the Saudi leader in that way, it's puzzling. It's very puzzling. In terms of what happened on the DMZ, you know, I think there is going to be debate, but certainly a sense of relief that the process is going again on a security dialogue front, and the process for denuclearization will be long and complex and will require a great deal of patience. We'll see setbacks. Let's hope the best of what that represented, not unlike progress made between Reagan and Gorbachev, or at least a meeting of really very different types of realities and the threat that North Korea poses. But in terms of the much bigger question, my students at Columbia asked me, you know, thinking that my answer will be North Korean missiles and nukes, what the biggest international threat is. I said the biggest international threat is the challenge of democracy under siege, the rise of nationalisms across Northern Europe and the Eurasian arc, and the setbacks to democracy that we have seen over the course of the last decade. And so for the harbingers of democracy, for those who fight in Hong Kong and for those who lift the banner, and in a world where you have Uyghurs in northwest China imprisoned as many as 2 million, and as you allude to, North Koreans, 140,000 in a modern-day gulag, these are really unjust, and we need countries like the United States to point out the injustice that exists and to set a moral standard in line with what it has done in its foreign policy.
Well, Stephen Norper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Norper, who's a professor and the Korea Society Senior Director for Policy and an associate of the Weatherhead East Asia Institute and Pacific Forum, CSIS, at Columbia University, a former State Department senior analyst. He's held fellowships at the East-West Institute, East-West Center, Korea's Institute for Foreign Affairs and National Security, and the Edward R. Murrow Center for Public Diplomacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.